Our next speaker will be Curtis Monger. He's going to be speaking on silicate clay and argillic horizons, Desert Project, New Mexico, and his co-authors are Bob Grossman and John Hawley.
Okay, thank you. Whenever Susan asked me to talk about clay skins and deserts, this project came to mind. It was one that Lee Guile asked me to put together in the mid-1990s. There was a lot of clay mineralogy that had been done in the Desert Project, and there were a lot of XRD patterns. And it had only been compiled in narrative form. So this presentation deals with the clay mineralogy, the clay skins. And as many people have already described, the Desert Project was a 400-square-mile area laid out by Bob Rui. And originally, Lee Guile had mentioned that he was going to include the Hornada Experimental Range, but later he felt that a smaller area where they could spend more time would be more constructive. So this is a block diagram. This is the original 400-square-mile area. So one of the early questions basically was, when you go to this desert environment, is what is the clay mineralogy? So there were 54 pentons that were analyzed for XRD, and much of it was in narrative form, so you can find the information in words like contains a small amount of fairly well-ordered kaolinite and so forth. But from that, they found kaolinite, smectite, and mica being the primary clay types, as well as a little vermiculite, chlorite, and then in the petrocalcic horizons, there was sepialite and palygorskite that April Ullery would talk about, and Brenda Buxton work on this as well. But there was also one clay mineral type that was very common that we could only identify it as mixed layer. So it's a real broad group, but it's an important in the alluvial soil. So anyway, these were the XRD patterns that we had. There were 22 pentons. So basically we did peak areas so that we could do a very semi-quantitative analysis of the different types of clay minerals. So with respect to kaolinite, it was ubiquitous in all of the 22 sites that were analyzed. And having grown up in East Tennessee on ultrasols where there were lots of kaolinite, I was really interested to see how kaolinite is very common in deserts, or at least this arid, semi-arid region as well. So mica was ubiquitous across each one of these sites. And smectite was more variable. In some places there was a lot of smectite. In other places, especially coming off the limestone soils, there was no smectite that was found. So this is a 3D figure, basically plotting on the vertical axis peak area. And then on this axis are the Oregon and Hornada II geomorphic surfaces. So basically we're looking at time going from Holocene in the late Pleistocene. And then on this axis are the clay minerals. So you can see that mica is uniform across all these different types, and so is kaolinite. There's a little bit of smectite scattered around, but here's the mixed layer clay that tends to be weathering out of the limestone. If we move over to the rhyolite, we have these pentons. This is pedon 5916. So in 1959, this was the 16th pedon that was analyzed. And this is a rhyolitic, very rocky material. And I'm pretty sure that this is the primary site where the dust hypothesis developed, because these rhyolites, first of all, had very little calcium in them, and they were very much unweathered, and yet they were indurated with the petrocalcic horizon. This is the way the site looks in 2001. So a petrocalc stage 4 with a laminar zone above a plug zone. And if you go up into the mountains, into the semi-arid region, this is pedon 60-5. So here's Lee Guile with a jackhammer going through that petrocalcic horizon, and that's the way it looks. So they broke through the petrocalcic, and this is the way it looks today. There's Wayne Hudnall. This was a desert project tour in 2007. So this is the very red, John Holly mentioned, it's a 2.5YR, very high clay, very ancient soil. It's on the Doñana geomorphic surface. So the rhyolites really don't have these other types of clays. They only have the mica, the kaolinite, and the smectite, but the really old soils have quite a substantial amount of smectite on them. So if we move into the monzonite, into the granitic material that's weathered, there are both alluvial but also pediment, in situ weathered bedrock. And here's a thin section showing the weathering of the bedrock. So here's a biotite that's exfoliating. Here's a weathered plagioclase. And these are in situ clays that have formed in place. And not only the smectite, mica, and kaolinite, but this is where you're going to find the vermiculites and the chlorites. A little more complex clay mineralogy in this bedrock type. So if we go over to one of the oldest soils in the project area, about 2 million years, I guess the oldest soil. This is on the upper La Mesa surface. So here's Bob Grossman, very athletic, contemplating the petrocalcic horizon in 1961. So it was this site that Van den Heuvel published his work, not only showing there's montmorillonite, mica, and kaolinite, but also in this calcrete he finds sepialite, and in those days it was referred to as adipulgite, now it's palygorskite. So this was quite the interesting discovery because, of course, it's known it forms in marine environments and aquatic environments like Playa Lakes and so forth. But to find it in the petrocalcic horizon was really interesting. And so subsequent work that was done using SEM in both this site and other sites on the lower La Mesa show the palygorskite fibers radiating out into the pore space, which would be evidence that it formed in place, that it wasn't part of the dust and alluviated down. Here are other SEM showing these little palygorskite fibers that radiate out into the pore space. So another question that came up during the Desert Project early days, according to Lee Gawa, was basically how long does it take to form an argillic horizon? And so a couple of sites that illustrate that. This is on the one of the younger geomorphic surfaces. This is the Oregon. And so the question is that an argillic horizon? Here is a deep pit showing that soil that buries older paleosols. But it's real important because there's charcoal in the sea horizon that gives a radiocarbon date of 4,200 years. So, of course, that means these pedogenic horizons are younger than that age. And thin sections show that there are some grain argillands, really fairy argillands, that give it that color. But there's not enough clay increase, so taxonomically it's a cambic horizon. Still an iridosol, but it's a cambic horizon, a simple haplocambid. And so again, the age, as you get younger than mid-Pleistocene, basically you don't have, in this particular region, argillic horizons. Okay, but whenever you step up to the early Holocene, this would be the Isaac's Ranch geomorphic surface, you have some really prominent grain argillands, and there is enough clay increase to get you into to an argillic or an argid or, you know, haplargid horizon. So similar studies can be done on the valley border region where there are stepped surfaces, and Vance Holly talked about this already, but for example, this is a Fillmore geomorphic surface. You step up to an older Picacho and step up to a Hornada 1, and again, is this an argillic horizon? And here's Lee Gao on 2007, 50th anniversary Desert Project Tour. So he's 87 here, and he's telling the group about this particular pedon. But again, what gives it that red color are these very thin fairy argillands that coat, but not enough for an argillic horizon. But whenever you step up to the next older geomorphic surface, some very prominent alluvial clay that gets you into an argillic and argic petrocalcid, okay? But with respect to clay skins in deserts, if if you're in the business of prospecting for them, you go to where the pipes are. So what are pipes? Okay, so this is a 1958 aerial photograph that I think was taken by Fred Peterson. So now it's very different today. There are probably 30,000 people who live along Highway 70. But this line that parallels Highway 70 is the Highway 70 gully side, and it's the old road that came across from the Tularosa Basin. But it intercepted a lot of drainage, and so it made this gully, and so it was very good for walking and documenting the stratigraphy. Miles and miles and miles of soil stratigraphy. And one thing that became apparent are these pipes that cross-cut the soil horizon. So this would be an example of a pipe and more pipes. But with respect to clay skins, whenever you do thin section analysis, you really find the really laminated clays with the extinction bands when you rotate the stage in the pipes. So with respect to the metaphor of soil memory, these pipes probably remember wetter times when there was more water being funneled down through these zones. The landscape with the oldest memory would be, again, the Upper La Mesa. And there are many, many pipes that go through this calcrete, and some of them are quite large. This is a very large pipe that records many episodes of dissolution, kind of a petrocharst type phenomenon, but also more arid periods. And so deep in this pipe is the thin section that demonstrates really the best clay skins in the Desert Project region would come from these old pipes. Okay, so how long does an argillic horizon persist? Well, it depends a lot on dissection. If there's a stable geomorphic surface, an argillic horizon can survive for tens, hundreds of thousands of years on these stable geomorphic surfaces. But the surfaces are progressively eroded away, and so you can change taxonomic classifications by erosion. So there are many infusols in this landscape that are young, not because of recent deposition, but because of recent erosion stripping off the overlying horizons. An example of soil dissection. So in this landscape, you would find soils that in similar landscapes have a really prominent argillic horizon sitting on top of the petrocalcic, but here it's been dissected away. Another thing that will destroy argillic horizons is faunal activity. There is a lot of bioturbation that occurs in these soils. Termites, for example, are always churning and building these galleries around cellulose that they decompose. So this is from Guile, 1975, where he's talking about boundaries of soil. And so these are different soil types, very hard to map out for a soil scientist walking across the landscape. But basically, these are bioturbated zones, and there are areas that haven't been bioturbated where there are remnants of BT fabric, and the BT fabric can be traced laterally down into the pipes. And so here you have a different sequence of soil taxa that are due to the destruction of argillic horizon. Then we have the impact of limestone alluvium, which not only affects the preservation of argillic horizons, but it has a big impact on their development to begin with. So this is a side-by-side comparison of igneous alluvium and limestone alluvium. So if you look at the igneous alluvium in this landform, again, very prominent clay films, clay increase, silicate clay, that would be an argic. And if you move just to the east, less than a mile to where you have the limestone alluvium, you have soils that have a lot of finely disseminated calcium carbonate in the form of K fabric or crystalline B fabric, but really no alluvial clay. So again, based on just the differences in parent material, you have different soil types. And I just wanted to end, people have some good pictures of BL. So in the early 90s, there was a field trip that John Holly and Dave Love and BL were leading in the it was really primarily in eastern New Mexico, but a little bit in West Texas. And so I wish I had seen Vance's presentation, because I would have known what to entitle this slide as. Okay. So the BL and BS. Okay. But here's BL, definitely has things under control. And John Holly is talking about this cowcrete that just really stimulated his imagination. He's going on. I mean, but basically it's wonderful, because a cowcrete like that will enable him to take people through the Pleistocene all the way into the late Pliocene just by standing at this one site. And then this one, I'm not sure if it'll be shown, but there's BL, there's Larry Wilding and Daniel Ahn. This was part of the ICOMID tour, so the International Aridisol Tour that Larry brought the folks up through Las Cruces. They went all the way to California as part of this tour. Thank you.